Okay, let's unpack this. When you look at the materials that make up your world, the metal on your phone, maybe alloys in a plane, how do you know that system is truly stable? Not just looking stable, but really settled, done changing, reached its final state. Today, we are taking a deep dive into the science of nothing changing, which is basically phase equilibrium. And we've got quite a stack of sources today. We're going to be looking at some complex phase diagrams, breaking down the physics of mixing energy, and exploring some really fascinating real-world stuff, things like historical pewter, right up to modern ceramics for really extreme environments. Our mission is to, well, rapidly pull out the core ideas of phase transitions and the thermodynamics that govern pretty much every stable material around us.
And that stability, it rests on a really elegant definition of equilibrium.
Yeah.
Simply put, an equilibrium state is one where, like our source material says, nothing changes no matter how long it is observed. Mm. It also means the system is stable against tiny disturbances. You can kind of nudge it, but it won't just flip into something else.
Okay, that sounds like stability, sure. But what's the underlying physical rule? What makes the atoms actually stop shifting around or changing phases?
The scientific driver, the absolute key, is uniform chemical potential. If you've got multiple phases present, maybe liquid and solid, or even two different solids, chemical potential, we use the symbol Dewey of every component has to be equal in every phase. If that's not met, the system will shift until it is.
Hold on. For those of us maybe a bit rusty on our physical chemistry, what is chemical potential exactly? Is it sort of like a pressure gauge for atoms wanting to move?
That's actually a really good analogy, yeah. Think of chemical potential as the driving force for mass to move. It measures how much a component, let's say component A, wants to leave its current phase and go somewhere else. Like imagine two water tanks connected at the bottom, right? Water flows until the level the potential energy is the same. Atoms and molecules, they do the same thing, but they're seeking equal chemical potential. If the chemical potential of A is higher in phase alpha than phase beta, A will just spontaneously move from alpha to beta until those potentials are equal. Then everything settles. Equilibrium.
Wow, and that single rule holds even for really complex stuff, not just simple mixtures.
Exactly. Think about something super engineered, like one source mentioned a 7-component steel alloy. Iron, carbon, nickel, molybdenum, maybe others. That system might have, say, 3 different solid phases all coexisting, each with its own crystal structure. But the whole thing, millions and millions of atoms interacting, is still governed by that one condition. Every single component must have the same chemical potential across all 3 phases. It's fundamental.
Okay, if that uniform potential is the destination, then, here's where it gets really interesting.
Hmm.
We need to look at the energy that drives the journey there. Why do materials even mix or separate? That gets us into the thermodynamics of mixing, right? Gibbs free energy, delta GMI.
Exactly. Delta GMI is like the energy landscape the atoms are navigating. For mixing to happen spontaneously, that free energy change has to be negative. The mixture needs to be more stable than the separate bits. And the simplest starting point is the ideal solution.
The theoretical perfect mix. Like everything just blends randomly.
Precisely. In an ideal solution, the atoms basically don't care who their neighbors are. A bonds, AB bonds, same energy. So, crucially, there's no enthalpy change. No heat released or absorbed when you mix them.
So, if bond energy isn't the driver, what makes them mix?
Pure randomness. Entropy. The free energy change is driven entirely by the entropy of mixing. So, the equation simplifies to delta GM equals initially delta delta SMA. Basically, there are just vastly more ways to arrange a jumbled up mixture than ordered pure components. The system naturally lowers its energy by maximizing its disorder, its randomness. And the sources point out this configurational entropy hits its peak and free energy its minimum right at the 50-50 mix. The equiatomic concentration, maximum randomness is maximum stability in this ideal case.
But yeah, the real world isn't usually that simple, is it? Oil and water don't mix. Alloys aren't always perfectly blended.
Exactly. And that's where we need the regular solution model. This brings in the energy preferences, the enthalpy of mixing, delta HMR. Now, the full delta GMR equation has both parts, that entropy drive for randomness and this enthalpy term that accounts for bond strengths.
Okay, can you break down that enthalpy part a bit more? What's it physically mean?
It's all about neighbor preference. When you mix A and B, you're breaking AA and BB bonds and forming new AB bonds. The enthalpy of mixing, delta HMY, just measures the net energy change from that swap. If the new AB bonds are, say, much stronger than the old ones, energy is released. Mixing is favorable, it stabilizes the mixture, and you tend to get complete mixing.
And if the AB bonds are weaker, if the atoms prefer their own kind?
then the system actually prefers the original AA and BB pairs. You have to put energy in to force those AB bonds to form. That positive enthalpy change fights against the entropy drive for randomness. And that often leads to phase separation, you know, like oil and water. So the final structure you see in a material, it's this delicate balance, this tug of war between entropy wanting disorder and enthalpy wanting the lowest energy bonds.
That thermodynamic battle really explains why systems end up with specific phases. Koi, let's take that energy landscape and apply it to something really practical in metallurgy, the eutectic point.
Yes, the eutectic. It's a fantastic example of thermodynamics enabling engineering. And the lead tin system is the classic textbook case. You've got pure lead, melts way up at 328 degrees C, pure tin, lower at 232 degrees C. Logically, you might think any mix would melt somewhere in between.
Right. But the sources clearly state if you hit this specific ratio, 62 weight percent tin in lead, so Pb62Sn, the whole thing melts sharply at just 183 degrees C. That's, what, over 100 degrees lower than even pure tin. How?
That sharp low melting point is the eutectic. By definition, the eutectic point is that specific composition where the liquid phase, L, transforms simultaneously into two distinct solid phases, call them alpha and eta Taylor, at the lowest possible temperature for that system. It's like the liquid is least stable right at that point.
But why does that simultaneous freezing happen only at that exact composition? What's the mechanism?
It comes down to diffusion and maintaining balance right at the interface. Imagine the liquid cooling. For it to freeze completely at one low temperature, both solid phases have to grow together without changing the overall liquid composition right where they're growing. So the alpha phase, which is lead-rich, starts to form. As it grows, it naturally rejects tin atoms into the liquid right in front of it. At the same time, right next door, the beta phase, which is tin-rich, is growing and rejecting lead atoms. They grow cooperatively, almost like partners. The tin rejected by alpha is immediately consumed by the growing beta, and the lead rejected by beta feeds the growing alpha. This local shuffling keeps the liquid composition right at the eutectic point, allowing the whole remaining liquid to solidify together at that single low temperature.
And what does that rapid sort of cooperative growth do to the final structure of the metal?
It creates a very fine, often layered or lamellar microstructure. Because the two phases are growing fast, side by side, relying on really short-range diffusion, you end up with, as one source put it, lots of interfaces.
Mm.
The exact pattern depends on things like cooling rate and surface energy between the phases, but you generally get these very fine structures which give the eutectic alloy unique mechanical properties, often good strength and castability.
Okay, and what if you miss that magic 62% tin mark? What if you're a bit off?
Good question. Then you get what's called a proeutectic phase first. Let's say you have less than 62% tin. As it cools, before you hit 183 degrees C, the liquid starts precipitating out just the lead-rich phase, the alpha, big chunks of maybe. But as that alpha phase forms, it's removing lead from the liquid, right? So the remaining liquid gets progressively richer in tin. Eventually, the liquid composition hits exactly 62% tin, and then whatever liquid is left solidifies via that simultaneous eutectic reaction we just talked about. So you end up with these larger primary crystals of alpha embedded within a fine eutectic matrix made of alpha and Deller dolls.
It's not just theory. This is fundamental to so many things. You mentioned pewter earlier.
Absolutely. Modern pewter relies on these low melting points. But even historically, the sources mentioned examples found in places like the Edo Museum in Tokyo. Items from the Shogun era, maybe 130 years old or more. These low-melting, easy-to-cast alloys, usually tin with maybe some copper, antimony, bismuth, were vital for making detailed objects long before modern manufacturing. They understood the practicalities of the eutectic, even if they didn't have the phase diagrams drawn out.
Okay, so we figured out what phases are stable based on energy and entropy and why they form these specific structures like eutectics. The next really practical step when you're looking at these phase diagrams is, how do you know how much of each phase you have? If you're in a region where solid and liquid coexist, for example, that brings us to the lever rule.
Yes, the lever rule. It's absolutely essential for reading phase diagrams quantitatively. In those two phase regions, say, solid alpha plus liquid L coexisting at a certain temperature, the diagram shows you what phases are there. The lever rule tells you the amount, specifically the mass fraction, of each one. You draw a horizontal line, a tie line, across the two-phase region at your temperature of interest.
I always like the name. It really does work like a little balance scale on the diagram.
It does, visually. Imagine that tie line represents 100% of your material. Your overall alloy composition sits somewhere along that line. That's your fulcrum point. Now, here's the slightly counterintuitive part. To find the fraction of, say, the solid phase, you measure the length of the segment of the tie line that points towards the liquid phase boundary and divide it by the total length of the tie line, and vice versa for the liquid fraction. You use the lever arm on the opposite side.
That inverse relationship is the key thing to remember. The closer your overall composition is to the pure solid phase line, the bigger the fraction of solid you actually have. It makes sense when you think about it.
Exactly. It directly connects the composition axis to the relative quantities of the phases. It's a simple geometric trick, but incredibly powerful for anyone designing or analyzing materials. And if we connect this back to the bigger picture, phase diagrams are really our essential maps for materials. They give us everything critical.
So if I'm looking at some phase diagram, maybe one I haven't seen before, what are the three key pieces of information I should be trying to pull out using these principles we've discussed?
Okay, first, what phases are stable at your specific temperature and overall composition? That's dictated by thermodynamics, by that uniform chemical potential rule. Second, what is the composition of each of those stable phases? You read those off the ends of the tie line where it hits the phase boundaries. And third, using the lever rule, what are the fractions or amounts of each phase present? How much solid, how much liquid, or how much of solid phase one versus solid phase two?
And while we've mostly used lead tin, a binary system as our example, these rules, chemical potential, lever rule thinking, they apply universally, right? Even to much more complex systems.
Absolutely. They are the fundamental grammar. When you go to ternary systems, three components, or quaternary, four, the diagrams become much harder to visualize. Often we look at slices or use computational modeling, but whether it's aluminum silicon, crucial for casting, or some complex multi-component ceramic, the underlying rules are the same. Chemical potential must be uniform at equilibrium, and the lever rule concept is still how you figure out phase amounts.
So what does this all mean? We started with a simple idea. Equilibrium is when nothing changes. We learned that the stability of basically every material hinges on this constant negotiation between entropy, the push towards randomness, and enthalpy, the preference for strong bonds. And it's all policed by this elegant principle of uniform chemical potential.
Yeah, and we saw how that fundamental understanding lets engineers actually design and control materials. We touched on that research into directionally solidified eutectic ceramics. They're using that same cooperative freezing we saw in lead tin, but controlling it to create highly structured, aligned materials built for extreme heat way beyond what normal metals could ever handle.
It really is amazing that just tweaking the composition, adding maybe 62% of something else, can drop a melting point by over 100 degrees Celsius. It gives such predictable power.
It does, and maybe that leads to a final thought for you, for the listener, to ponder. We know these thermodynamic rules are universal. If changing one component in a simple binary system like lead tin can have such a dramatic effect, creating that low melting eutectic point, think about those really complex systems, those seven component steels or advanced ceramics. What other unexpected, maybe incredibly useful phase transitions or properties might be lurking in those vast, unexplored compositional spaces, just waiting for us to find the right combination? The principles are there, but the potential for discovery, especially for materials in extreme environments, feels almost limitless.